What's up, Fungal Associates? Welcome to Completely Arbitrary, the podcast about trees and other related topics. My name is Alex Kroos, and I'm one of your hosts. And in this corner, we have Casey Clapp.
Yeah. What? That's it? In this corner, this other guy.
Sorry. Yeah. I was going to go into a big thing, and I thought, you know what? The people don't want to hear that. They just want to hear the episode.
As you hear all the people be like, boo.
I think I'm a little tenderhearted this week because we spent 15 minutes talking about hamburgers last week.
Yeah, so good.
I loved it.
Yeah.
I think we should do that as a podcast.
Yeah, we can't. We'd get sued.
By the Doughboys.
Yeah, there's already a podcast doing that.
Yeah.
I mean, we could do it, but it wouldn't be interesting. We could just talk about hamburgers and people would be like, what the fuck are they talking about?
Right.
It's a
waste of your talents, Casey.
Thank you, Alex. I think that's kind of you to say. I also have to admit, I think it's a waste of your talents as well.
I think it's a utilization of my talents.
You think, okay, well, you are a man of many talents, so perhaps it's both, depending on the talent we're talking about.
Hey, speaking of the Doughboys.
Yeah, all right.
Our friend, yes, I officially have her number in my phone, and we've texted.
Wow.
Allie Ward of the superstar podcast Ologies.
Go look it up.
Where you got your little start. That's kindergartner Casey Clapp.
Hey, I was just talking about trees, like with all these stars in my eyes.
That's right. She was on Doughboys if you're listening to this, it was on last week. So go listen. Yeah. Doughboys is my favorite podcast. I've listened to it for like 7 years or some shit.
Yeah.
So much wasted time. She was on it, and it was like this crazy clashing of worlds, and I realized that there's one person between me and Nick Weiger, one of the hosts of Doughboys,
which means Mike Mitchell. Super, like at some point in the future, you will certainly make that 0 degrees of separation.
If
you will know them.
Listen, if Nick Weiger and Mike Mitchell want to be my friend, invite me to barbecues, we can go out for, I don't know, McDonald's or something. Sure. Would I love that? Sure. Is it my highest priority? Yes.
But, you know, other priorities will fall by the wayside.
That's right. Today we're talking about a tree, and that tree, hey, we're going down under once again.
Yes, we are.
The Bull Banksia.
Banksia grandis is the name.
Casey, I've heard of this tree.
You have? What have you heard?
One of my favorite sitcoms.
Okay.
Kath and Kim.
Uh-huh.
Any Australian listening is like, oh, brother. But I love it. It's an Australian show.
Uh-huh.
And this couple on that show is like on the beach and they're having like a romantic evening laying on the beach together under a blanket, right?
Yeah.
And they're talking about potentially having a child.
Oh.
It's this very romantic conversation.
Yeah.
They decide, yes, they want to. And then he pulls the blanket up over them and they start, it's insinuated that they're fooling around.
Oh, I gotcha.
And she goes, Kath. Goes, that feels nice. What is that? And he goes, oh, sorry, that's a Banksia cone. And he pulls out this cone and throws it across the beach.
You watch such dumb shows, Alex.
Casey, how dare you say that?
Oh, it's just, I know exactly the kind of scene. It makes me laugh.
It's wonderful. It's a wonderful show.
Yeah. So that is, that's how you know the
Banksia.
That's
how I know of the Banksia, is that it was on an Australian TV show, and it was insinuated that it felt like his dick, I guess,
the joke. Yeah, if it's a bull Banksia, I bet you it's a, this is substantial.
This guy's packing,
yeah,
I guess.
This guy knows. they know what's up. That is, I think that's a fair description for our tree today. It's of all the trees that are, or all the plants that are called Banksia, it is the most well endowed.
The bull Banksia specifically? Yeah. Okay.
Exactly.
Well, so bulls are well endowed.
I was going to say, I assume that's why they call it the bull Banksia, but I don't know.
Is because it looks like a big bull's dick?
No, I don't think so.
What did you mean when you said it, that you assume that's why they call it that?
I feel like a bull is like big. This is one of the bigger of the Banksia, but only in terms of its fruit.
I thought you meant, whatever.
No, I think these are on the same track. I don't necessarily know that they said that flower looks like it's got the size of a bull's
penis.
Dick. So then they named it that. I think they're just like, oh man, that thing's huge. That's a bull of a flower.
Right.
You know what I mean?
And the way that a bull is like a big thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Now, to be very clear.
Let's move on.
No idea.
No idea.
I have no clue why.
Oh,
I have
sure.
No clue why it's called the Bull Banksia.
Yeah.
It's one of those things where to me it seemed obvious, so I never looked into it.
Okay. Well, Casey, we're talking about the Bull Banksia today, but we're going to take a quick break, get ourselves some coffee.
Going to get ourselves prepared
for the Bull Banksia.
Give them the horns.
Welcome back to Completely Arbitrary. Today we're talking the Bull Banksia, Banksia grandis,
yes.
If you're nasty.
Honestly, I think if you're nasty, you should do it in like Victorian English style, Bull Banksia.
You might be better off with an Australian accent, Casey, as this tree grows down under.
Sure does. Down under on the southwestern corner of Australia, right there on the land that we didn't know existed.
Are southwestern.
Yes.
I'm less familiar with that side than the side that's like more populated.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like the east of Australia is more populated than the west side.
Gotcha, yeah. This is the area where it grows.
New Queensland, is that?
No, Queensland is up in the north, on the northeast side,
New South Wales.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's, actually, I don't know where North South Wales is. Doctor, pull the map up, would you?
Okay, Casey, I've got news.
How's your cartographic skills?
I'd say poor.
Okay, okay.
To very poor.
Poor to very poor.
So the western third of Australia is called, get this, Western Australia.
You know what? I love that.
Then you have the Northern Territory.
Okay.
Which is like an Idaho-shaped chunk kind of in the upper middle.
Okay.
Below that, you have South Australia.
Yep. Okay. This is also still making perfect sense.
And then on the west, on the east side, rather, from top to bottom, you have Queensland, New South Wales, and Victoria.
Uh-huh. Okay. Those are all the, are they provinces? Is that what that is?
I believe they're states.
Okay. That sounds good.
So, Casey, let's imagine that you and I are walking through a forest in Western Australia.
Hey, that sounds good.
And we come across some bull banksia. I'm almost assuming these grow by the water.
They do, yeah. But they also grow kind of up to a certain elevation.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, we find some at any of those elevations. Let's ID this tree.
Let's do it. It is. I think we can properly say tree. And the reason I think that we can properly say tree is because I looked it up specifically. So I had never heard of Bull Banksia or really done any diving into Banksia to begin with.
Okay.
Until one of our listeners basically said, hey, you should also think about these other cool trees down here in Australia. So I was like, hey, that's a great idea. And I tried to figure out who this is. We had so many responses and questions. I couldn't locate it. So whoever you are, you know exactly who you are. And thank you.
Thank you so much.
And the trees, which I think we should call them trees.
Okay.
If we call the pomegranate a tree, I think that if we don't call the Bull Banksia a tree, we get canceled right away.
Easy now.
So the tree that we're talking about is a small tree for all intents and purposes.
Okay.
And it grows all the way on the coast, and on the coast, it really stays even smaller. It is similar to our shore pine over here, or a lot of different coastal species, where when they grow right next to the ocean for whatever reason, they are really stunted. Sometimes the soil is just not there. Sometimes it's salt spray. Sometimes it is the wind just howls so hard, usually with salt spray.
This was going to be my theory. My theory was that it's harsher conditions, so they want to have a smaller footprint.
Yeah, exactly. And you can only grow up
to have a smaller footprint, I guess.
Yes, I think either one. You could probably say that they've adapted to it, and so it's better for them. But then also the wind will shear them off if they get too tall. So it's a little bit of like, okay, let's make a deal here. I'll grow like this. You don't destroy me.
Does the Bull Banksia grow like a normal tree? Like it has leaves and I know it has a flower and it has what we'll call like a tree cone hyphenated. Yeah. Right?
Yes.
Has a hyphen cone.
I think it's fair to, exactly. So it's not a true cone.
Right.
Yes, 100%.
It's like a magnolia in the way that a magnolia has a cone.
Actually, yeah, that's perfect. That is the best, I think, like good analogous that we could use. Analogous? Analogy? It's not an analogy.
You know what I'm
amalgam.
You know what I'm going to say?
What?
It's like almost like a flower's skull or like a flower's skeleton. Right?
I like that. Yeah.
Because it's like this thing that the fruit was growing in.
Yes. Well, yes. Yeah. Correct.
But then once the fruit kind of dies, it's left with this husk.
Yeah.
I'll let you talk about it.
It's really interesting, Alex. I think you're going to like it. And I need you to look up. I need everyone right now, whatever you're doing, unless you're actively driving, don't do this.
Or like performing surgery or something.
Yes, or something like that. And if you can, have your assistant do it next to you while you're in your surgery room.
Scalpel. Banksia.
Thank you. You should definitely look up just look up Banksia cone is the easiest way to find it. And you'll see this. You'll see what we're talking
it's
about.
It's a scene, man.
Right? So, okay, before we do that, let's finish talking about this tree and all the other things. It's kind of like, hold on, before the ice cream, here are your peas.
Right.
Here's your mashed potatoes.
Yep.
And because we are a vegetarian family, tofurkey.
I want you to eat 3 bites of carrot.
Before we talk about the Banksia cone, okay?
Please, Mom, please.
Okay, so it's not a technical... No. Here's your carrots. So on the coast, they grow very, very stunted. And then as you go further inland, they actually get a little bit higher onto... Get this. It's called the Darling Plateau.
Wonderful.
I love it so much. Mm. Like, I would live on the Darling Plateau if I was there. I mean, everywhere I live is just the Darling space, for sure. But
I like your confidence.
Hey, thank you, Alex. So the Darling Plateau is also famous for having the jara, which is this really amazing tree.
Yeah.
It's a eucalyptus, I think, marginata. And it's some of the hardest wood in the entire world. It's really cool stuff.
Really quick.
Yeah.
Remember my big rant about regional pronunciations?
I think so, yeah.
I believe it's called Jarrah.
Oh, okay. Yeah, you're probably right.
Only because there is a hot beverage company in Australia called Jarrah.
Oh, yes. We've talked about this before.
Yeah,
and I missed
it.
Okay, Jarrah. I'm going to say Jarrah. Okay. You're right. It grows underneath these big trees in association with that as a forest type. So, gets a little bit higher up there, and the way these trees grow is very candelabra-like.
Ooh.
You remember when we did the trumpet flower, the trumpet tree, where it grows up, and it kind of has no flower or no foliage kind of lower down.
Yeah.
And then it kind of pops up with these big things kind of at the ends of its branches. That's kind of what our tree does here. The Banksia, the grandest, the bull Banksia.
Mm.
It grows up and then it kind of splits off left and right, and then it splits off again left and right, splits off again left and right, and it has these spirally arranged, some species are whorled, which is essentially all of the all the leaves come off from one spot. But a whorl is like technically different than a very, very tight spiral.
Okay.
Very tight spiral is more alternately arranged, but very, very close. So you can't really tell that they're alternate. That is what the Banksia has, is it's very, very tight spiral, or as it grows faster, the spiral's kind of pulled out like you're pulling a slinky apart. That is kind of how you can imagine. And then everywhere around on that spiral pops out a new leaf. Pop, 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 pop.
Like a big, long curly fry.
Yeah, exactly. But sometimes if you stretch that curly fry...
I'm leaving it in.
Damn it, Alex. Your power.
Sometimes if you stretch that curly fry...
out, you end up getting a long spiral versus when you let it pull itself back together, then you end up getting this really tight spiral. And that's just kind of how you can tell the difference.
Interesting.
Or imagine the difference. It's hard to tell sometimes. That's the point. So you got this amazing candelabra look with this dark kind of gray bark, initially smooth, but then it becomes really like warty and rough, dark gray. Mm. And it kind of looks like... it kind of looks like worn pavement, kind of, is what it looks like to me. And it's really like, it's kind of gorgeous. It looks rough. Like, it looks like something you don't really want to deal with. It certainly is utility bark, but it's not utility bark in a strict sense. Like, it's got a little interesting texture to it, like a bunch of little bubbles.
This is like utility bark, but we're not using that derogatorily.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, we're which is, I think, is a difference.
This is utility bark.
Yeah, rather than, this is utility bark.
Yeah.
Get out of here. That's, I think, the best way to describe it. So as it grows up and you see these amazing leaves, which everything I've read, which there's so many different garden like entries about this. Every time I looked up a description, it was all like this garden shop, that native plant thing, this thing right here, that thing over there.
Okay.
It's not a heavily used plant in the garden industry. It is in some points, but Banksias more broadly are, there's like 170 some species. Most of them are from Australia. They're all from the kind of new flora since the age of discovery, so to speak, down in the kind of Guangdong and South American or South Southern Hemisphere kind of area.
That was booing the age of discovery.
I was like, wow, Alex, that's pretty hurtful. Oh my God.
I will say aesthetically, it's pretty niche.
Yes.
So it makes sense to me that it's not big in the garden community.
Right. But man, it should be. And a lot of people are saying you definitely need to plant these. If anything, you should plant them for the foliage and that is it.
Yeah.
They have leaves that are, they're called pinnatuspect.
Wow, say that again.
Pinnatuspect. Pinnatuspect. Something like
pinnatuspect.
That.
Pinnatuspect.
Yes.
Wow.
So it's okay. Kind of like, instead of being, so a pinnately compound leaf is one that there's a bud, and then underneath that bud is the leaf. That leaf grows out, and then little leaflets come off. Those leaflets are distinct, and the blade, the actual green blade of the leaflet, does not contact another part of the leaflet.
Okay.
And that, so they're all separated. There are breaks within the leaf blade.
Right.
On, apparently, and this is a new term for me, I had never heard it before.
Yeah, me either.
On a pinnatuspect leaf, everything is so close to being actually pinnately compound, but they are connected just the tiniest bit.
Okay.
So if you look this up, pinnatuspect, you'll see like a lot of ferns and things like that where it looks like there could be a thing. It's more of a description rather than like a state of being.
Okay.
So it's like, these are pinnatuspect. They're not quite exactly pinnate. They're normal, technically entire leaves with just big, big, deep lobes.
I see.
And this looks like the lobes of a, the lobes are like these big triangles.
Yeah.
So it looks like a saw. Like,
yes. I was going to say like a swordfish's snout.
Yes. Oh my God. Exactly. Yeah. That's totally it. So it's really intense. And actually, I don't think you're thinking swordfish, Alex. I have to say, I think there's there's like a sawfish.
Yes.
Okay. That has that exact same kind of thing.
Yes. Sawfish.
Okay. So this is the sawfish leafed tree.
Hell yeah.
Oh my God. If you look closely, they're all connected at the base and they're offset just slightly. So you have like triangle over here connected to triangle over here, just offset from triangles on the other side. And they grow out about 16 inches or so at max. So they're these like big, they look pinnately compound, but they are not, leaves that come out in these big whorls. And they're like this kind of bluish greenish color. And they're just gorgeous.
Yeah, like, really, really interesting looking.
Right?
Extremely unique. I've never seen another leaf like this.
Exactly, which is, I think, just an Australian thing. Everything is just unique. Yeah.
Remember that listener question we got that was like, why are Australian trees so weird?
Yeah.
And we kind of balked at it. We were like, well, I wouldn't say that. And now the more we look at Australian trees, I'm like, I think they were right. Well, Casey, can we finally get into the ice cream here?
All right, here you go, kiddo. You did a good job. You got all that fiber.
It's like a big soft serve cone.
It is. Thing. Like, oh my God, what else can we describe this as? Are we hungry?
Maybe.
Luckily, Alex, yes, we can talk about this.
All right.
This is the classic Banksia, where it has a spike flower that comes up from the terminal end of a twig, which is why it has that growth form where the branches come out and then there's another thing, another spot, then more branches come out.
Yeah.
So it's almost like a U on top of a thing, which is on top of another U. You know, every end of the U has another U attached to it.
Sure. We're talking like a sports bracket on its side.
Yes, exactly. Totally. That's the exact idea.
Yeah.
That is because the flowers grow at the terminal end of the new growth. So the new twig comes out and then it puts all its leaves and then bloop, there it is. The new flower top comes out.
Great.
And the flowers are these little pairs of tiny little flowers that are jammed right next to each other on a woody axle. Mm. So the woody axle grows up and it sets all these pairs of flower kind of circling around it. And then they start to bloom from the bottom up, usually.
Wow.
Yeah, and a lot of plants do this. I think there might be a few that go top down, but I couldn't really see anything that really confirmed that. Suffice it to say, as the flowers are set, the outer petals and perianth, that is usually one color. And then oftentimes when it opens up, the actual pistons and stamen and things inside are another color.
Yeah.
And then it looks like the whole flower is kind of going from, say, a yellow cream to like a pinkish cream as it opens up, because then you get the outer thing kind of opening, showing this new color, and you can kind of watch it go
beautiful
up the entire thing. For our plant, usually both are kind of a yellowish greenish color.
Oh.
So they kind of all stay the same color going through.
I thought you were talking about the Banksia.
I'm sorry. Well, we're talking about other Banksias kind of broadly.
Oh, but this bull Banksia doesn't do that.
Exactly.
So much.
Oh, bull okay. Banksia does not do that. And the bull Banksia has the distinction, which is why we assume it's called the bull, is because its flower spikes are the biggest of all of the different Banksia species.
Oh, okay.
The record for how many flowers they found on one flower spike of any Banksia species is the bull Banksia with something like 6,000. They get like almost 12 or 18 inches long. Like, I've read a lot of different things about like the size that they can get. So they're these big giant flower spikes that can grow out there, and they have this woody stem in the middle with those flowers embedded into it.
Yeah.
It's really a fascinating kind of plant.
Can I say, when I Google Banksia cone,
yeah,
this is like colloquially
yeah.
called a cone?
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah, so technically it is not a cone by any means.
Of course, yeah.
But what were you saying?
Well, when I Google Banksia cone, I get a lot of hits for Etsy.com, Casey.
Yes, you do.
And people use this thing to put lamps, to make lamps,
oh,
and
yeah.
sculptures and all sorts of stuff.
Yeah, that is one of the biggest things I've also found, is that like if you look up Banksia on the Wood database, it doesn't actually give you any information about the Banksia wood itself, which
yeah.
apparently is very warped inclined to warp, and it also is kind of a reddish color. Apparently, there's not a whole lot of like, yeah, Banksia wood. It's just kind of the biggest ones. Put on some wood, you can use it for stuff, but it's not like a good timber species or used for a lot of stuff.
Sure.
My best guess is that it's because of the growth habit, where you don't generally get these long, big pieces that you can now mold into something. But they said they use them for yokes, but that's because they're kind of that perfect size that you can just get one that's the perfect U shape to put around a bison or whatever you're using to do something.
I will say the Banksia cone should come with a trigger warning for our friends who suffer from tryptophobia.
Oh my God, that's right. Yes, don't look at them.
Yes.
Ooh.
It's kind of creepy.
Yeah, it really is. And it looks weird weird is yeah. the only way to describe it.
Okay.
Let me try.
This is a science podcast.
Science podcast. Weird. What's up? Weird science. We're going to be on Nickelodeon in no time.
God, I hope you get slimed.
I've been slimed, actually.
Have you really?
Yeah. In fact, funny enough, this is the second time it's come up in like a matter of days.
Yeah. Sliming?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I guess last week I was talking with some friends about it, and they're like, what was it like? What did it taste like?
You got slimed.
Yeah, I got slimed. Yeah. Yeah.
When? You were a child.
I was a child, very young. Probably
Universal Studios?
Five or six. Yeah. Down in California.
Yeah.
Yeah. We watched like a live show. They're like, and we're going to pick one of you guys to get slimed. And then I was like, this little kid raised my hand and I got slimed.
Of course.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. I'm so envious. Did it taste like vanilla?
You know, I don't recall.
Okay.
Everyone asked about like, what did it taste like? And I don't remember tasting it, honestly.
As far as I know, they use like really watery vanilla pudding.
Yeah, that would make very much sense. Yeah. But it was great. I remember it, and I kind of never thought about it until someone brought it up at a get together the other day, and I was like, oh yeah, I've been slimed.
It just makes perfect sense.
Does it? Okay.
Yeah.
I got to ask my mom about it. I know she has pictures. In fact, I kept the shirt that they gave you afterwards
really?
For a long time.
So Casey, what is happening with this cone?
Alex, I'm glad you asked. So it is a normal, not cone. So everyone's like, well, it looks like a cone. So what's the difference? The difference being a cone is the reproductive organ that holds all the seeds. The
right.
seeds are not inside an ovary. In this, all of the seeds are inside of an ovary at the base of the flower. And that base is embedded, like we said, inside of this woody axil, which is right in the middle of this entire fruit.
Yeah.
Now, there are, you know, hundreds or thousands of flowers on this individual thing, but only a handful of them actually get fertilized.
Oh.
And when those get fertilized, the old or the ones that didn't get fertilized will either die away and like fall off, and you just get like this kind of small little holes where there used to be some flower parts and then they kind of fell off.
Mm-hmm.
In other species, they'll actually stay on the tree and kind of look like this dead kind of hairy stuff hanging off of it. The flowers that did get fertilized, they will start to get bigger as seeds grow inside of this woody section.
Oh, so is that why there's sort of a smattering of holes across
yes.
this thing? Those are the holes where the seeds got fertilized.
Precisely.
Where the flowers got fertilized.
Yes. So each individual fruit is called a follicle. And a follicle has one suture line on it, and it only opens on the one side,
yeah.
which is the outward facing area.
Okay.
And it opens up and it kind of goes, bleh. Yeah, exactly. And you get like, it looks like a little mouth.
Yes.
It's just kind of like, bleh, and then pops out the little seeds that kind of flutter away in the wind.
I hope there is some experimental absurdist filmmaker living in Australia who used a Banksia cone and like the imagery of a Banksia cone in a scene where all these little mouths are talking to the main character.
That would be so good.
It's got to happen. It's got to be a thing.
It's got to be a thing.
Yeah.
Now, a lot of times in some species, they'll kind of open up. In our species, they will open up on if there's a bushfire or something like that.
Oh.
And the heat causes them to open, then they fall over and
sure.
then you're regrown again. Now, the fun thing about this is that they grow inside and connected to this big woody axil. So on the bowl Banksia, again, it's the biggest fruit of all the Banksias, and those follicles will open up, and sometimes that entire like fruiting body, which is the best way to describe this quote cone,
mm-hmm.
can be up to like 12 inches long and 5 inches around. So it's like a big, big thing. And you can take that. It's woody enough when you dry it. You can put it on a lathe and you can actually shave it off into different shapes and things.
Whoa.
Hence why you get so much Etsy hits when you Google Banksia or bull
sure.
Banksia.
Yeah, I saw a box made of a Banksia cone.
Oh my God. It must be a tiny box. I don't know how big you can make a box with
well,
that.
I would assume they would probably take several of these and slice them into
there
planks.
You go. Yeah.
So it's woody enough to be able to work with woodworking tools.
Yeah,
so it's
exactly.
not brittle and it wouldn't fall apart necessarily.
You know, yeah, it doesn't fall apart. Now, we're specifically talking about our tree. Other Banksias, you know, may not have the same characteristics.
Okay.
But yeah, this one's at least big and woody enough that you can actually use some pretty heavy tools on it.
Wow.
And it won't fall apart. Apparently, it's quite smooth if you do it very well and correctly. And you can cut off all the outer sections so you get this smooth thing that's just tiny little holes, then one big hole, then tiny little holes, then one big hole, where like that mouth opens up where that follicle was fertilized and actually had that seed inside.
Mm.
So you get like this kind of, it's like there's polka dots all over this kind of embedded within this piece of wood.
Yeah.
So it looks like normal wood with these really, really weird characteristics.
So to return to my previous kind of musing,
yeah,
that this reminds me of a magnolia quote cone.
Yeah.
Are they the same, like botanically, are they the same part? Would you?
Yeah.
But like, I mean, but you seem like hesitant to go there or whatever. Like you have to think about it.
Yeah.
But is it like scientifically, yes, these are both Woody axles or whatever.
I think so. I think the main difference is the cones, the way that the spike of flowers grows on the Banksia, mm-hmm. botanically is just a little bit different than how the Magnolia is set up.
Okay.
So I think in broad strokes, yes, they're the same thing.
Okay.
In fact, I would have to, again, look this up to make sure. Mm. But my understanding is that the Magnolia is an aggregate of capsules. So it just kind of also opens up, but they open up vertically and then the seeds pop out.
Yeah.
Whereas for this, they open up horizontally. So
it seems like a negligible difference.
Yeah, so I'm not really sure. I didn't do a comparison between the two. So this is a very good question, Alex.
Let's try to think of a third plant that has a similar botanical part.
I can't.
We'll be right back with more Completely Arbitrary. I'm just joking.
Oh, you are? Oh, God. I was ready to go for it. I was ready to end it. Remove
Casey
it onto the
leaned
next
away
section.
From his mic.
I did. I thought that was it. I was going to look up all the questions to all of our answers.
That would have been fun.
Oh, well.
It's impossible now.
Opportunity lost. Well, Alex, now that our opportunity is lost, here's the thing that I really kind of, I found myself diving into.
Yeah.
Which is what I do, historically speaking. I would do my own personal version of the Wikipedia game that we did one time here mm-hmm. on the show. The idea is I love going down rabbit holes with things and just, and Wikipedia is such a low stakes, you know, reading thing for me where you could go into so much detail that you're blinded about something and miss all the actual intricacies that are curious, going so deep onto something that you're like, this is too much.
Right.
You can also go way too shallow where you never quite know what you're doing.
Yeah.
But if you hit that sweet spot, you can just go and read through histories and connections and weird things and find yourself going down rabbit holes you never quite thought you would get to. And so this isn't quite that, but as I was looking through here, I was like, okay, yeah, I know this is named, the Banksia is named after Joseph Banks.
Now, yeah, for each episode we do, you have kind of like a hook.
Yeah.
There,
I try at least.
We'll say we want to do an episode about this tree. Okay, yeah. Great. I don't when we and we don't really know what that's going to look like.
Yeah, yeah.
Because
yeah.
we need a subject. Very rarely have we just talked about like kind of anything and nothing. You
yeah,
know?
Most of the time, I think the closest we get for that is just talking about the tree itself.
Right,
like, it has like, so many interesting things.
Yes, which this totally could be.
Yeah,
but you got hooked on something, and that
I
is
did.
This gentleman. Joseph Banks.
Sir Joseph Banks.
Just the most capitalist name I've ever heard.
You think so?
Yes.
Yeah, I don't think that's out of the question of a fine conclusion.
It's biblical and capital.
It does. He's got it all.
Yeah.
Oh, poor Joseph Banks. His destiny was done.
No pit trap for this guy?
No pit trap. In fact, I think, let me see. Yeah, he died in London, and he seemed to age a good 77 years.
That's not bad.
Yeah, so he lived a good life. And I must say, he in this one photo that, again, it's on the main profile of his Wikipedia mm-hmm. page. It is in 1773, and man, he's got like dashing, like kind of late 20s, early 30s, like good looks to him. Like his hair's pulled back right. He looks like he's kind of cool, you know, like he looks like he's in the prime. And I'm like, dude, well, that guy's it's a good looking guy. He knew what he's up to.
I want to clarify that this is an oil painting Casey's referring
yes.
to.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Which are famously, you know, doctored by the painter so they don't offend the person being painted.
But dang, look at that brow, man.
Yeah.
Come on. Like, I don't know.
He's got a good strong nose too.
Yeah,
doesn't he?
Does. He does. He's got a little bit of a smirk. Like he looks cool. So I was just looking through and I was like, okay, let me remind myself who Joseph Banks is. So I decided I would remind everyone else as well. So his pedigree is pretty insane. He's not a Scotch botch. He's just a normal English botch.
Okay.
And he does, he appears all over the place because he was an adventurer, but he was also like very well respected. Charles Darwin, for example.
Yeah.
He was well respected. He went on his big adventure and then came back and then focused on things for the next 40 years.
Okay.
His contemporary, who also came up with the idea of evolution by natural selection, was Alfred Russel Wallace.
Hmm.
Alfred Russel Wallace was not very well respected. He was like a tradesman who came up with this fantastic idea.
Huh.
Because he went down to some tropical islands and would catch beetles and butterflies and birds and then send them back. So that's how he would make his money. I know, you wince because you're like, oh, God.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's what he did.
Okay.
And so he made a lot of money from that, but he was never like a gentlemanly class guy from doing it. No one really gave him Alfred Russel Wallace much credit. Every now and then someone would read him and be like, oh, yeah, okay, this guy's might be on to something, but he wasn't a gentleman in the society. You know what I mean?
Okay, sure.
So why I bring up those two is because they're very well-known names.
Mm.
Joseph Banks was the epitome of kind of both of them, where he was an explorer and went off and did all sorts of stuff and was also like super well respected. Like he was in the Royal Society, I think, when he was like 23.
Remind me what the Royal Society is.
So the Royal Society is the Royal Society for like natural study, the study of the natural world.
Okay.
And whenever you hear about the all these old timey Victorian and prior era explorer folks who were all the Scottish botanists of their day, they are usually a part of the Royal Society, and they would focus on one thing. So say botany or physics or chemistry or something like that.
Okay, so it's the natural sciences sort of like British union or something?
Yeah, that's kind of the easiest way to do it, to kind of think about it. So it was formerly the Royal Society of London for Improving Natural Knowledge.
Okay.
And it's a fun thing. All the big names that you've ever heard of in terms of natural history, they were probably a part of this if they were born on the English Isles.
David Douglas?
David Douglas, I'm sure he was. All right. Think he was, but I don't know for sure. I'd have to go through, but I would be willing to bet.
Linnaeus?
No, because Linnaeus, if he was, then it would have been different because he's part of he was Dutch, wasn't he? No, he's Swedish.
Oh, I thought Linnaeus was Scottish.
No.
Who am I thinking of? Who's the other Scottish?
David Douglas and Archibald Menzies.
Archibald Menzies.
I'm sorry, Mingus.
All right.
So, so most of those guys, most of the big names, all of the things, like Newton was a part of there's all sorts of these sects of the Royal Society.
And did they allow any women in this society?
Oh, God, no. This is London in 1770. Get out of here.
All right.
I think over time, probably, I don't really, to be honest, and I'm sorry to say this, I don't keep up with the Royal Society today.
Excuse me?
Pardon me.
So you are not a gentleman, sir.
Slap. So back then, this was it. And, you know, everything that we could bring up about this, you know, you hope that there was this this sense of purity with what they were doing in terms of like, we just want to go find new plants and study natural things.
Pretty optimistic.
It is pretty optimistic. And if you try and think about things from this age, which to be very clear, none of anything we say today is any kind of apologistic kind of argument.
Never.
Apologist. Yeah.
It's quite the opposite.
Right? This is with open eyes. These people were working at a time when what they were doing seemed to be good and right and for the better of society. It just so happened it was very much only their society that was right and good and better for.
Mm.
And nobody had ever, you know, went to them and said, please stop. This is really bad for other societies. They thought and their minds worked so differently that didn't even occur to a lot of these people. And it was like, oh yes, we should definitely get this land and take it over, or we should go find all these new plants. And it was always be exploration. Everything was new to them. We still fall prey to that all the time. Like, oh, this thing was discovered. And it's like, well, okay, I bet you it wasn't just now discovered. You're cutting off all the rest of human history for, you know, millennia and millennia going back.
And I'm guessing this wasn't a nonprofit organization.
No, definitely not. No, this was the, English-British Empire.
Right.
quite for profit. And so the thing that is interesting about Joseph Banks is that
that was their slogan back in the day.
Quite for profit, actually.
The English Empire, quite for profit.
Yeah, right. So they
it's very British.
This is the best thing about this. So he ended up becoming the president of the Royal Society for 41 years.
Hey, good for him.
Which is huge. Like that's just like that's a massive, massive thing.
That's big, yeah.
And he also was like a super intellectual about plants and natural history and animals, like all these things. So whenever anyone had anything to say, they would go to him. And so there's
a Casey Clapp of his day.
Oh,
huh?
Wow. Thanks. Yeah, I'm definitely not on his level, even as a scientist. Like, even though he had the mind and atmosphere of a imperialistic, colonistic capitalist, he was famously a part of the very first transit or the first sailing of Captain Cook, the famous Captain Cook.
Oh, wow.
And the very first, what was that?
I just said, man, it's so weird to think that these things existed. I don't know.
Dude, and it took him 3 years to go from Britain down across the Atlantic, underneath South America to the island of Tahiti. From Tahiti across a couple of the Society Islands to the west, then finally ran into this place that they're like, okay, here's what we're going to do. We're going to look for this isle. And this is the thing. It was like the unknown continent that may exist. Because at this time, and this is in the late 70s, I think it was 1767? 68? 68. It was 68. And they would have no idea. They had no idea that there was this continent down below. And when I say down below, I mean in the southern hemisphere. They knew about Africa, and they knew about South America and North America.
Down under, if you will.
I think that's proper. But the thing is, they also knew all about Asia and Europe. So they thought, in order for the planet to be balanced, there needs to be a giant landform at the bottom.
That was their theory?
That was their theory since like the 5th century. That was the first time that was...
Really?
That was brought up. Excuse me.
I guess they weren't wrong.
They weren't wrong, but...
Their reasoning was wrong.
Yeah, right? They...
Balance.
They would say... there's also a lot of this from the 15th to the 18th century where that really became the common understanding. There must be a giant landmass very far south, or else the planet surely would fly out of balance and flip into some other orbit.
So weirdly smart and dumb.
Right?
I don't know.
It is. It's almost like taking some like really high level concept, but applying a child's logic to it.
Yeah.
So it's like you both have mastery and complete dumbery. Is that a mastery and dumber?
Yeah.
All right. Ooh. Nice. You apply both to the same thing at the same time. See where you get. Wow.
Yeah. We know that we discovered that there's this thing called gravity. Because, see, we're being held upside down by a giant. So anytime you drop something, it falls to the ground.
Yeah. That makes perfect sense. Yeah. We must find this giant. That's what we don't know.
It's an ice giant. And we're going to call it Antarctica.
Ooh, scary.
I bet Antarctica was once an ice giant.
Yeah, probably. And then now it's actually just sleeping or something.
Yeah. The sleeping ice. This is like Moana. But,
ooh, this is. Yeah, this feels ice. Good. I like it. Yeah. All right.
Frozen meets Moana.
Oh.
Let's pitch it.
Yeah, to Bob Disney? Iger. All right. Yeah, I think we should do that. So what exactly happened is they kept going and they found this place that a Dutch man named Tasman had found, which is New Zealand and Tasmania.
Sounds familiar.
So he went there and like got in a bunch of fights with the Maori on New Zealand.
Yeah.
And they had guns because, of course, this is still on one side. Captain Cook is working for like King George III and is like, hey, we want to find new things to colonize. This is the thing that we're doing. Whether or not they were doing it thinking like, yeah, we're going to fuck up the world. Or if they were just like, yeah, this is what we do now. This is the way the world is. Let's just assume for a second that maybe a couple of them were just like, this is going to be a huge adventure. And every now and then, if you just take away everything, which I know we shouldn't and we can't do, but if we did, Could you just imagine, Alex, like this, like going to a different planet where if you just can say, we're going to earnestly just go see what's out there and then you find something.
That would like, be pretty wild.
Oh my God, right?
Yeah.
And not only do you find something,
oh man,
you go down, like you say, okay, we're pretty sure that the planet is circling around the sun, but we're pretty sure that there's a planet on the exact opposite side of the sun from us at every point that our gravities are interlocked, kind of like two kids holding hands and swinging around.
Mm-hmm.
You have to have the one to balance the other.
Okay.
I'm pretty sure there's another planet on the exact other side of the sun that's exactly like Earth.
Right.
Let's go see if we can find it. The math works out. We would fly off into that galaxy otherwise. I'm pretty sure that's the case. And your response is, dude, totally. Let's talk to the president and let's get a couple billion dollars and go over there. The president's like, bro, this is like 100% solid logic. Here's your money. Go find us. Go see what's out there. And then we go out there and we're like, we high five because we fucking totally found it.
Yeah.
There it is. We're like, this is sweet. Oh my gosh. Look at all these crazy things. And then you just see this whole new world. The question that was asked a while back, why are Australian plants so weird? It's because that entire place had been broken off from all the other different flora and fauna for maybe 50,000 years at the minimum, likely way more than that. I mean, people got there around 50 or so thousand years ago.
Okay.
All the plants and animals had been apart from everything else for millions and millions of years before that. So imagine two different planets that have just completely evolved differently. We go there and we find it. They're like, whoa.
Yeah.
Like, I have to admit, the sense of adventure and like of finding something, thinking it's out there, finding it, and then actually seeing what's there. Whoa. Like, it sounds like a dream, doesn't it?
Yeah. You know, this is tricky for me, Case.
Yeah.
I have a very hard time separating the colonialism from the quote sense of adventure.
Yeah, definitely. You can the narrative has been told too much as a sense of adventure where it almost becomes this romantic notion.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah. Which is, you know, some very common in like maybe this is, hopefully this isn't too off topic, but going back to like elementary school in America.
Yeah.
Learning about American slavery. In the same regard, learning about the quote explorers.
Yeah.
You know,
and like Lewis and Clark going over.
Lewis and Clark, Columbus.
Yeah. 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 It's all, they call it, like we said earlier, the age of exploration.
Right.
It's like it was for one of you, but for the other of you, it was maybe the age of let's go find however many people however many spaces we can to get more resources.
Yeah.
Whoever's there, we don't really care. Don't kill them.
People to enslave.
But we might kill them later.
Yeah, so it's really hard for me to be like, it's to hear this story and be like, wow, yeah.
I know.
Because I just have it in my, and it's like a sinking feeling in my gut, like knowing what happened right after that.
Oh, yeah, exactly. No, I mean, it wasn't even right after. It was the whole time. I mean, Captain Cook got off the islands and planted flags and, formally, you know, claimed this for King George and the crown.
Yeah.
So it's, you're exactly right. And I think like why this came up with Banksia is because obviously I went down this path with Joseph Banks and started looking at Cook and his voyages. And there's an image of Captain Cook on Australia, I think. And then there's these Aborigines behind, like in the background, you see like these two figures.
Mm.
And in the front ground is like, you know, all the, there's, I think, a British soldier in a red coat, a Marine who's like, you know, kneeling, looking towards those other people. And then you have, you know, this captain in this grand, like almost George Washington kind of like planting a flag moment kind of thing.
A bull mastiff at his heels.
Yeah, right. It's like all these, this big imagery and everything. And when I was looking at that, the first thing that popped into my head, I was like, I wonder what that beach looks like now. And then you can like scroll through and you can find a picture of that same beach.
Yeah.
And it's like right next to a bunch of development. It's a perfect little beach. There's like a nice little rock wall that's there to like basically keep the tide from going up and eroding away. Mm. And I'm like, oh, I wish. This is where the romantic part comes into me, which we've talked about on the show before, is the idea of going to anywhere in the world prior to, let's say, the year 6,000 BC, or even let's just go to 10,000, like before agriculture really started to take hold of our entire societies.
Yeah.
Like I would love to go back 12,000, 30,000 years and see what the world looked like in all of these different places that before they were completely destroyed and changed by humans the way we do it now. Because humans have been affecting the landscape in their habitat for as long as humans have existed, yeah. As long as they've had like fire, which is something like 200,000 years or more.
Wow.
So I'm not trying to say there's this romantic notion of the land untouched by humans versus touched by humans, but I think it's fair to say in the last 2,000 years, we've touched the earth a different way than we did prior to agriculture.
Sure.
You know? So that's what I'm trying to, you know, think about. Like,
what's the landmark you're putting at 2,000 years ago?
2,000 years ago was just, it was like, you know, the Romans were just kind of moving around, mm-hmm. and they were doing a lot of work, but everything was by hand. There was obviously a lot of moving of things. It just happens to be that in the last 2,000 years, the amount of impact we've had and change on our environment has exponentially increased. So if I was to be completely like, you know, perfect about this, it would be going back, let's say 12,000 years to account for everything. The agricultural revolution, quote unquote, hadn't happened yet. So it's still like hunter-gatherer bands or foragers running around doing all their things.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone was interacting with their environment in the way that they always have. But at that point, we didn't clear land for certain things. Maybe it was done by fire. Everyone would affect the land and their habitats to get certain things. A lot of the folks over in the indigenous people in California, for instance, would use fire for clearing out land for oaks that have, you know, the favorite acorn. In Australia, certainly was the case where the indigenous people would use fire, or the landscape was so fire prone that they would just light a fire, it would change the landscape, and they would know how to work within it.
Right.
So at least before agriculture, because once we had settled societies and we started having wars and we started doing all these things, everything changed.
Yeah.
So agriculture is, in my opinion, the thing that has changed our entire world in every possible way.
I don't think that's that much of a hot take.
Okay, I don't think it is either. I think it's just a take that a lot of people don't really think about or don't really like fully grasp.
I mean, like, yeah, the Industrial Revolution is the big one, right?
Yeah, that's the one that everyone's like, that changed the world.
Yeah, and I'm
like,
but you're making an argument that it was before that, the proto-Industrial Revolution was agriculture.
Yes, and everything that was in place to make the Industrial Revolution happen was because of the Agricultural Revolution.
Right. Okay.
So, I mean, everything from like how our societies are organized, like monogamy is only potentially, I'm being more and more convinced, is a relic, is an artifact of agriculture and agricultural societies.
Boy, that is a whole different episode.
Right?
We could talk about that for hours, Casey.
Yeah. So let's bring it back to our tree.
Yeah.
So these, the Banksias are named after this guy, Joseph Banks, mm-hmm. who introduced something like, brought back 30,000 different plant specimens back to London.
30,000?
Yes.
In one trip?
I'm not sure if it's one trip. It might have been.
I mean, you want to grab as much as you can. You're not going to be back for a while.
Yeah, I think this just says, it just says, maybe it might be the first thing, but at least 30,000 he brought back with him. It doesn't say specifically the time frame.
Okay.
And over 1,400 of those were things that he actually identified and quote, discovered, you know.
That's a prolific man of his trade.
Right? But, damn. I mean, think about the situation he was in. You go to Australia, every single plant that you see is new. So you give him some credit, but also, like, they were there for, I think, like 6 months or something, maybe elsewhere for 6 months.
You just start picking.
Yeah, pick literally anything, and it's brand new to science. Like, imagine walking out into our forests and just name anything, like point at something that's new.
Yeah.
You know? So here's kind of where everything comes back to our Banksia. So we named our tree the Banksia, but we name it after this guy who, from a certain perspective, was really integral in the natural sciences, mm-hmm. which is something that a lot of people really enjoy and respect, and it's very important. But the way it is now is maybe eyes a little bit more open to the impacts that natural sciences have and the effects that it has on societies and peoples and cultures that maybe are not so Western-centric. Yet at the same time, it caused so much trouble.
Yeah.
Like the entire idea, everything about colonialism and capitalism and the names of these plants as we know them now are wrapped up and completely entangled with where we are today now. And thinking like, well, actually natural sciences is more focused on conservation and addressing the issues that we've created over the last 2,000 years, mm-hmm. things like that. So it makes me like, it's a hard dissonance, you know, to really like think through and conceptually come to terms with the idea of, say, reverence for Joseph Banks through naming this amazing plant after him specifically and all the things that he's done to push our sciences forward. But then knowing that, on the other hand, he literally went back to back to Britain and was like, this would be a great place to colonize. We should definitely do it right here. From one side, if you just look at, you know, the additions to what we now consider a modern science. Thanks, Joseph.
Yeah.
You look at everything else and you're just like, no thanks, Joseph. Yeah.
We're going to take a quick break. And when we get back, we're going to get into our review of the Banksia, the bull Banksia.
Bull Banksia.
Right after this. We'll be right back with more Completely Arbitrary. Welcome back to Completely Arbitrary. That was our discussion of the bull Banksia. It's time for our review. And here's how it works. We're going to have some final thoughts on this tree and then give it a rating of 0 to 10. Golden cones of honor, Casey.
This time, it's going to be golden Banksia cones of honor.
Oh, very good. Golden woody axles of honor. As our resident ethical explorer, we'll begin with you.
Yes. Okay, perfect. That sounds great. Thank you, Alex. I appreciate the introduction. I really was taken by this tree.
Yeah.
And I want to go down to Australia, New Zealand, Tasmania. I want to go to that entire area to see all of the plants and all the weird ways that they've developed. Because for me, the big thing about this and why our discussion was kind of like a free-flowing talk about, you know, this guy and like the sense of exploration and all these things, it to me, like the plant itself, in its uniqueness and curiosity and gorgeous beauty, it's representative of this this world that kind of developed all on its own, which is the continent of Australia, or rather Terra Australis Incognita.
Is that the Latin name for Australia?
It was before we knew it existed. That means the unknown southern land.
Oh, interesting.
So they were going down trying to find this thing, and I think that a poster child for that entire idea of like this unknown land is the Banksia. Like, you could name almost any plant that grows down there, and they're all so unique and interesting.
Yeah.
So I love this, and I'm taken by the fact that the irony that we name it after, you know, Banks and all the rest of these things that kind of come falling from that kind of initial step.
Yeah.
So the irony is there, but I still think if we're just looking at this plant for exactly what it is, they're stunning.
Yeah.
And I think the cone of it is so unique and curious that it just tickles me. The tree is not a big tree. From what I can tell, it's not a big street tree kind of thing. You don't plant it often in gardens. It's just kind of this tree that's over there that just kind of hangs, and everyone's like, yeah, there's the Banksia's over there, bull Banksia. It's enjoying it. And it's somewhat fickle if you get it to like too much humidity and things like this. So it's a tree that just likes to grow exactly where it's growing, and everyone is just okay with that. And so I think for the bull Banksia, I'm going to be like it's going to sound low, but it's going to be a 6.9.
That does sound a little low for what you were ramping up to.
Yeah, I know.
But it's
almost
a 7. That's good. 6.9 golden cones of honor.
It's been a big day of like contemplation for me, Al.
Sure.
So I hope that's okay.
Yeah, that's okay, Casey. Yeah. I am curious. I want some Australians to write us about their opinions about this tree.
Yeah.
Because I always think it's funny, like a couple of times we've been like, wow, this tree is so beautiful, and somebody writes us and they're like, it's a fucking nuisance.
Yeah.
It grows everywhere. I'm so sick of it. And we're like, oh, okay.
Whoops.
It's like, it's all about perspective. The bull Banksia, I think it's fine.
Okay.
I think even aesthetically it's fine. I have some mild tryptophobia. I'm not like,
oh.
It doesn't really affect me, but I look at it and I kind of like, my throat gets wet, you know?
Oh,
I'm like,
really?
I get kind of like hot mouth a little bit.
Dang, I had no idea.
I don't know why. I think it's pretty good looking tree. I like the overall morphology of it. I like the flower. I don't know. I'm not feeling super passionate about it. It might have something to do with the story we told today.
Sorry.
It's okay. It's a tainter. It'll taint. That's Larry David.
Oh jeez.
I'm gonna give it a hearty 5.7.
Wow, a hearty
I'm just not
one.
Feeling that great about it.
All
I don't
right,
know why.
That's fair. Well, I think maybe if more people plant it, that'll change it.
If somebody wants to send me a Banksia lamp, I can go and find this thing and buy it
find
myself.
Yourself a Banksia.
I just don't want to invest in one.
Yeah.
But I'm happy with somebody else doing it.
Okay, there you go. Yeah. That's
or if somebody
fun.
Out there makes Banksia stuff, I'd like to have a Banksia account in my home. I think that'd be pretty cool. That was our review of the bull Banksia. Oh. It's time for our completely arbitrary Q&A. Casey, this week's question comes from Lisa D.
Oh, right.
Lisa D. Da, da, da. You know that song?
Nope.
It's from Greece.
Oh.
But it's Sandra D. in Greece.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Sandra D. Yeah.
Hi, right. Casey and Alex. I just finished reading Suzanne Simard's Finding the Mother Tree.
Yes.
It's terrific. Anyway, it got me thinking about mycorrhizal networks.
Yeah.
And whether they exist or can be nurtured in non-forest settings,
mm-hmm.
like on city streets and in yards. She mentioned the Three Sisters planting done by Native Americans.
Yep.
But is there any research or practitioner know-how about if and how street or yard trees support each other or can be co-planted so as to develop supportive fungal networks?
What a lovely question.
Thanks for your question, Lisa D. Casey,
Alex,
I think I asked this a similar question about house plants back in the day.
I think I remember this.
Like, are my house plants like communicating with each other? Mm-hmm. Are they on a network, even though they're all in separate pots?
Yeah.
You know?
Do their pots have Bluetooth like all of your bulbs?
Right. Do they send out little pheromones to say, hey, it's cold over here?
Yeah.
It's feeling pretty good over here.
The other one's like, I'm gonna get ready for it being cold now.
Right.
Yeah.
But that's not really related. So what do you think about this street tree mycorrhizal network? It's like social media, right?
It is. This is a good question. This is the social network of plants, I suppose.
Yes, yes.
You know, so there are a lot of different things that urban forestry researchers are really looking at for this. So there are certainly fungal networks associated with almost every plant.
Okay.
In general, all the trees that we have growing in your streets as a street tree or in your front yard, your backyard, they will have some network, especially if they're native, just kind of in the soil.
Okay.
They just are there. Fungus is everywhere. And whenever you see any fungus like popping up out of your yard or out of the areas of planted or mulch or leaves or whatever, those are usually a part of some larger network. The question is, are they mycorrhizal fungi or are they fungi that are doing decomposition and that's kind of it, right?
Is okay, yeah. I think I understand.
Okay, yeah, there's the two different kinds. Michael Reisel, and then there are the decomposers. All they do is decompose things. They're not making any friends. They're just running their business. And then things can use their stuff afterwards, but they're not actively connecting two things together okay. and doing them at the same time.
Okay, so that's the question.
Yeah, so there certainly is. Every tree, most of them at least, will have that. The big thing that changes, that means that maybe some do and some don't, even though they're the same species, same area, same kind of, within the same city, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
Are the conditions within that soil where they're planted conducive to have fungus? Where if you are downtown, all you're doing is growing in a really compacted, disturbed soil area, and your fungus or your roots are going down into a underneath the street where it's mostly gravel and there's some other poor spaces and things like that.
Little Freudian slip little, there.
Yeah, poor. So those little trees, they don't get a whole lot. They don't have sure. really, the fungus can't survive, even though the tree could be there giving them things. There might be a small amount of fungus, but the fungus is not growing deep within the soil. Fungus is always usually, I say always usually, on that top section in the top maybe foot of soil. You know?
Like a mat. We've discussed a mat of mycorrhizal
fungi. Yeah, exactly. Once you get too far down, it's just not there.
Okay, so when you plant a street tree,
yeah,
do you use like Home Depot bagged soil?
Some people do, yeah.
Okay, so does that bag of soil have fungi in it?
Generally not.
See, this is a problem.
It is. Now, some are. There's some organic, you can get really good products where they actually inoculate it with certain fungus.
Okay.
And then put that out there and say, yes, as soon as you use our soil, there will be a fungus, a mycorrhizal fungi network in there.
I'm guessing if you buy locally from like a small provider, like Dean's, is that like a local?
Yeah, Dean's has one. There's a few other places. But even so, that soil is pretty much inert. Like they would have compost and then sand and then another thing and they just mix them all together.
Oh.
So the soil itself is still not alive. There's no stratification. There's no soil layers. There's not a whole lot of really biological activity in there.
Okay.
You have to add things like mulch from a tree to jumpstart that process.
Gotcha.
So the organic matter is where the fungus is living and eating along with all the other living stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Once you get down to just kind of the mineral soil section, there's not a lot of life there. And what is there usually isn't working together with something else. It's just doing its own thing.
Oh, okay.
So the other bad thing is if you did get the soil that has these fungus in it, these fungi, who knows if that's the kind that's going to be good for the tree that you're planting.
Oh, sure, yeah.
Yeah.
There's no one-size-fits-all fungi.
Yeah, exactly. There are certainly generalists that's like one-size-fits-a-lot.
Oh, sure.
But you could...
One-size-fits-most. I've seen that on some hats.
Yeah, right? They're there. You can find the hats of those soils. So the thing is, you have to really develop the entire soil spectrum in order to actually get the fungus to really have good habitat that would then make the habitat better for the tree.
Or should I say caps?
You should say caps.
Like mushroom caps.
Yeah. Sorry.
Sorry. I didn't hear that. I didn't hear what you said for the last 10 seconds because I was formulating that.
Oh, that's fine.
Joke.
The joke we say in air quotes.
Okay. So a TLDR of this answer is...
Yes.
Yes and no.
Exactly. Yeah.
Sometimes and then sometimes not.
Yeah. The best way to do it is to... create the best soil conditions and then the fungus will come.
Right.
The best way to do that is to use some amount of wood chip mulch on the top of your trees wherever they're growing.
Wood chip mulch.
Yes. And that's what comes out of the back of a chip truck once they, you know, remove a tree, prune a tree, do something, chip it all up. It's that stuff that you throw down. Fungus will get in there, start to decompose it.
Cool.
And then other fungus will match up and find the roots.
Thank you for your question, Lisa D. Hey, if you've got a question for us about trees or other related topics,
mm-hmm.
join the Patreon at the $3 a month Quercus and Alder. That's Q&A tier.
And we should also note that you can also join at the $1 tier. You just want to be a tree hugger, give us a little bit of support, a little thumbs up.
That's right.
We accept all thumbs up, all of them.
Especially ones shaped like a $1 debit from your checking account.
Yeah, exactly.
Above that is the $5 Arboretum tier. You get two bonus episodes a month about a host of subjects. They're fun. They're free form. They're more relaxed, less edited than the episodes you're listening to in the mainline feed.
It's like hanging out with us.
Yeah, it really is. And then above that is, of course,
the Cone of the Month Club.
The Cone of the Month Club. We should call it the Golden Cone of the Month Club because it's very prestigious.
It is. It's quite prestigious.
Like, it's our most popular tier.
Mm-hmm.
You can get a unique die-cut cone sticker illustrated by an independent artist. What do I mean by that? Every month, we get a different artist to draw a conifer cone.
That's right.
I should say illustrate a conifer cone. In all different kinds of styles from as many different artists, each month we will send you a sticker of that art in an envelope with a little info card so you can learn about that tree.
Mm-hmm.
You can look up the artist and see their other work.
Mm-hmm.
And it's sent directly to your actual physical mailbox. It's a lot of fun. We have a lot of fun doing it. That's above that is Arbitrary Plus, our live stream tier. You can watch one live stream a month with Casey and I. One live stream a month with just me playing a tree or nature themed video game. Also a lot of fun. And then above that, Casey, we got generous admission.
That's right.
$20 a month or whatever you choose to, if you really want to roll out the red carpet for your support of this podcast. However, any tier supports this podcast. Even just listening to the podcast for free supports this podcast, and we appreciate your patronage.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Tell your friends, tell your family, tell anyone you want, or keep it to yourself, and it'll be our little secret.
And with that, we say thank you for listening to this episode of Completely Arbitrary. We'll see you next time. Goodbye.
I'll see you later. Completely Arbitrary is produced by Alex Croson and Casey Clapp.
Our artwork is by Jillian Barthold, and our music is by Aves and the Mini Vandals.
And you can support the podcast at patreon.com/arbitrarypod.
And find additional readings at completelyarbitrary.com. Thanks for listening.